We'd like to take this time to open our meeting this evening. We turn it over to our city attorney.
Yeah, I want to do a quick roll, just for the record.
Roll call, please.
Councilmember Fass?
Here. Councilmember Bettencourt?
Here.
Councilmember Beck?
Here.
Councilmember Salino is not here. Mayor Pinon?
Here.
So we'll get started. This is the required 2-hour biennial ethics training. So as you all, I think everyone has taken it before. Even Frank, have you taken it?
You did 2 years.
One time.
It's been a while.
Okay. When we were in Sacramento.
Yeah. So required every 2 years. We're splitting it up this year into two separate meetings. Sylvia said that we want to have 2-hour special meeting one night, keep everyone real long. So we'll do it for an hour tonight and then an hour in 2 weeks.
I like that.
And I will say this is a smaller group than I think we anticipated, but so be it. It is available online too, but I mean, we do these trainings all over. I've done these trainings in the city of Fowler. I've done them before here in Reedley, Clovis, some of the other clients that we represent, County of Madera. So the program's pretty much the same. We do try to update some of the examples that we have, although I think most of the examples are at the end of this presentation. So tonight, you got a handout. We'll go through it. It's going to be up on the screens as well. The handout you have is for the full 2 hours. We won't go through the entire handout today. We'll cut it in about half, keep it at about an hour, and then we'll roll into the regular meeting. So again, why are we here? We're here because it's required pursuant to the government code that all elected officials and also some non-elected officials, for instance, Nicole, even some of the higher level department heads are required to have this training every couple of years.
Yeah.
Planning commissioners, other appointed commissioners. So they're also required to take it. So it doesn't have to be live. It doesn't have to be in front of me or the city attorney or whoever. It's also available online. But again, sometimes it's good to have it live. Feel free to ask questions as we go through it tonight. There's not always easy answers. I think the biggest thing I want to leave you guys with is being able to spot issues and then ask questions. You can always shoot an email to Nicole, give her a call when you meet with her in your weekly or every other week meeting. Hey, got this issue, you know, take a look at it and see. Oftentimes Nicole will call me. We'll kind of, you know, talk it through and see whether there's a potential conflict of interest or something that one of you may need to recuse himself from the meeting or for that particular item. You're not going to be able to necessarily come up with the conclusion right there, but just know to spot the issues and ask the questions, and then we can go from there. So another important thing to make sure, we want to keep out of the headlines in a bad way. We don't want any of the Reedley City Council members in the Fresno Bee headlines or any other paper headlines for doing anything bad. So far so good, knock on wood. I don't think we've had any of those, but you'll see some headlines as we go through the presentation of some things that did go wrong for some folks, and luckily none of that's happened here. So the four required topics that we need to cover, and again, we'll cover two of these tonight and two of them in a couple of weeks. So the requirement for the ethics training requires us to cover laws relating to personal financial gain. So that's bribery. We'll also go over the conflict of interest laws. The second topic that's required is the laws relating to personal advantages and perks, such as gifts. So we'll cover the gift requirements. So again, there's gift reporting requirements. There's certain gifts that will cause you to be disqualified from participating on the consideration of a matter. And then there's also gifts limits where you can't accept certain things above a certain limit. So there's a couple of different things that we'll go over with that. Travel payment restrictions, use of public resources, those other things that we'll cover in that section, that second area. And then topic number three, again, we'll cover this in a couple of weeks, government transparency. So that basically it's the Form 700, the financial disclosure forms. And then most importantly that we cover there is the Brown Act, which all of you all are, you know, pretty well familiar with that. But we'll review the Brown Act requirements again in a couple weeks. And then finally, the fair processes. So incompatible offices, you know, due process requirements, bias, common law bias, as opposed to what we cover tonight as a common law conflict of interest. We'll, tonight we'll cover the actual statutory conflict of interest laws. Then there's the common law bias or conflict of interest that's going to be covered in a couple of weeks. Number four, I guess we had a recent example.
What do you mean by common law?
Well, again, basically it's kind of the, sometimes we touch on it too. So tonight we'll cover the Political Reform Act, which is basically the statutory conflict of interest law that lays out all the requirements for, hey, you can't have more than $500 interest in this, or you can't be within 500 feet of, you know, whatever it is, for real property matters. The common law bias is basically just the old common law. Before there were any rules or regulations, it was like, hey, you know, is there an appearance of impropriety, or would just the normal person on the street think, you know what, I don't know that Bob's going to be able to really make a fair decision on this, just because, although you might not, it might not, you know, touch the materiality standard that's in the legal, the Political Reform Act, it might not meet those standards. It's just like, you know what, let's go beyond what's written in the statutes and say, look, can Mary really be fair on this particular item, or should she step out and recuse herself on this particular matter? So that's the common law bias.
No, thank you.
No. Just the common law is basically old judicial opinions and things like that, really, that relate even all the way back to old English law. But as I was saying, under number four, we had kind of a recent example that touched on some of that. And again, we'll get into more detail in a couple of weeks on that item. But if you'll recall the matter, the Faith House, I guess, is what it was. And I sent you all a memo saying, hey, be careful about meeting with the folks outside of the meeting context, because it could create issues for potential bias or, you know, things of that nature when the decision comes to the council for formal action. So that's one of the areas where, you know, it comes up every once in a while. So again, an area that was, Nicole said, hey, you know, there, I think some of the council members were being contacted about having meetings with these folks. Okay, what do we need to do? And so we try to get together and make sure that you guys are aware of what the restrictions are and then able to navigate your way through. It's not always pretty, but I think we handled that one pretty well. I mean, there was some things in the meetings, but it, you know, ultimately you guys made an informed decision and nothing was, no laws were broken, I will say. You know, the decision is what it was. Not everybody was happy with it, but you guys, you know, handled it perfectly, I think. So let's go ahead and get started. And then we do have one bonus area. It's just kind of the general ethical principles beyond the law. Again, you know, the law sets forth certain requirements, but at least in my experience with all of you and most of the cities and counties that I work with, people go above and beyond what's legally required. You guys are all good folks. You want to make the right decision. You're doing this for the right reasons. You're obviously not getting paid a ton of money to be city council people. So you're doing it because you want to help your community, and you really want to help, you know, make the right decisions and do the right thing. So that's kind of what that last little general area is. That's the government code provision that requires the topic. So, some basics and background information. Some public corruption. It's important to know, obviously. It's important for the public to be able to trust the governmental process. So as local officials, I mean, this is really kind of the nuts and bolts of where people deal with their government officials, you know, on a day-to-day basis or a week-to-week or every couple of week basis. Most people don't deal with the federal government on a regular basis. State government, maybe not, but local city councils, school boards, you know, local agencies, that's where you're closer to people. So it's important for the public to trust that process. And I will say, you know, honestly, when I come to the Reedley City Council meetings, I mean, I think it's a good thing. Some people may not think it's a good thing. We honestly have the fewest number of members of the public at these meetings as compared to some of the other cities and obviously the counties that I go to. And I think, and honestly, I think that's because the people in Reedley trust you. They've seen you all in action. They've seen the decisions that you make. So they don't come to the meetings. Most of the time, the people that do come to the meetings at the other places I go are coming to gripe. You know, they're coming to speak at public comment about, you know, I don't like this or I don't like that, or you need to do this and you need to do that. I think it's a testament to you all that we really don't have a lot of members of the public here. You know, there's the occasional thing where it might be a somewhat controversial project where you may have a large group that wants to speak on it. But other than that, I think on a week-to-week or, you know, meeting-to-meeting basis, they really trust what you guys do. We don't have, you know, a large group of folks here. So I really do think they trust what you all are doing, and they trust the process that's in place in Reedley. So I think that's good to know. So just that's my little words based on, you know, some of the meetings that I attend.
They call us and meet us at the church, at the store.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
which isn't necessarily a bad thing. Obviously, in a small town like this, you know, it's not a bad thing. And then you guys follow the process, and you know, if it's worthy of being relayed on to Nicole, it gets relayed on to Nicole, and she handles it. So that's another important thing we won't necessarily cover in depth, but council roles, city manager roles, I mean, those are all important in a small city like Reedley, to know that the council, you guys act as one. You know, you're not out there individually doing things. You can't promise, you know, someone in the store, hey, can you do this, Mary? Well, you can't make any promises. I'll refer to the city manager, and we'll see what we can do from there. So corruption, you've seen some of the stuff in the headlines, and we'll get into some. There was actually a study done in 2014. There was an in-depth look at public corruption in California, and it was designed basically to help people understand, okay, what are some of the cases that have been going on? This one focused particularly on California, and there were 70 corruption cases that were studied. Money was involved in over half of them, power usually in all of them, greed, whatnot. I mean, it's just, you know, it's for all the wrong reasons that people were maybe doing this. I will note, too, the Fresno County DA's office about 4 or 5 years ago, I think it was Egan, before Smitkamp came in, I think it was Egan that started the public integrity unit. So there's actually a small unit of DAs in the Fresno County DA's office that focuses on issues related to, you know, local politics, local corruption. I've even been contacted by one of the DAs in that office about, you know, one of the clients I have, not Reedley. I will say it's not Reedley, but they do look into allegations. You know, the grand jury makes certain recommendations as well, but the grand jury doesn't really have a whole lot of power. They can issue reports and things like that and make findings and recommendations, but really, unless it gets to the DA, nothing, at least of a criminal nature, obviously, is going to happen. And usually, it won't even. Sometimes the FPPC may get involved, but really, unless it gets to the DA, not a whole lot's going to happen. But Fresno County DA does look at that stuff. So just a little bit further on this 2014 study. So as you can see, there was bribery and monetary misconduct is the majority of the cases. I find it interesting, the third bullet point. So of those 70 cases that were studied, so these were 70 corruption cases in California, 18 involved state officials. I think state senators, assembly members, even some other state agency officials. 13 involved federal officials, so federal officials located in California. But 39, so over half of the cases involved local agency officials. And local agency would be considered, obviously, cities, school districts, even counties, I think, were considered local for that, special districts, things like that. But again, as I mentioned before, the local officials are the ones that are closest to the people, usually. You know, it's easy for someone in Reedley to come to the city council meeting or to a school board meeting. Not as easy for them to go to Sacramento and go to, you know, the assembly and watch something. So it's important that the local agencies are operating in a manner that's, you know, doesn't involve corruption, doesn't involve political bias or, you know, conflict of interest and things of that nature. So, again, it's important. Over half the cases involve local agency officials. Now, again, you could say, well, the vast majority of officials in California are local agency. There's 5 city council members, or in some cases, 7 city council members. So you have, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of city council members and school board members across the state, as opposed to, you know, assembly members or senators. But still, it's important to note that it happens even at the local level. The study was intended to raise awareness about corruption and also encourage public reporting of misconduct and then increase transparency in government. So some local cases. I included one local case. It's getting kind of dated at this point, but I don't know if any of you remember the Operation Rezone case out of the city of Clovis. It's going on, 25 years now. So it actually, 94, so this was even before I was out of law school, but it involved some rezone developers intending or wanting to rezone property. And so what happened was they were offering up, or the council members, a few of the council members were saying, hey, give me, you know, a $5,000 or $10,000 contribution to my campaign fund, and you get my yes vote. It wasn't all 5 of them. It was 3 of them. And that's, again, as you guys all know, you only need 3 votes to approve something. So they didn't go after all of them, but a few of them did get caught. The developer, and in this case, it wasn't necessarily the developer that had started it. It was one of the council members in a private meeting, similar to what, you know, we were talking about earlier. Hey, can I meet with you, Mary, in private? I want to tell you about my great project that's coming. Okay, nothing wrong with that. But when you have those private meetings, in this case, the council member was saying, okay, sounds like a great project. I sure would like to vote yes, but I'm coming up for re-election, you know, next year or in a couple years. I sure could use a little campaign contribution. How about you, you know, provide a $5,000 contribution to my campaign fund, and I think you got my vote. And that's what was going on. So when the developer, in this case, the developer was like, this doesn't sound right. So then the developer went to the FBI and started to cooperate and wear a wire.
Golly, just like in the movies.
Yeah. So the council members resigned. I think 2 of them may have served some jail time. Obviously, city embarrassment. So they actually did go all the way through and approve the rezones and general plan amendments and things of that nature that the developer had requested. Obviously, all those had to be unwound because those decisions were invalidated because they weren't, obviously, they were based on bribery and corruption. So it wasn't a good time, obviously, in Clovis. Since then, brand new council members. There was one holdover, Harry Armstrong. I don't know if you remember Harry. Harry was one that was not involved, obviously, in Operation Rezone, and he was still around for a number of years thereafter, since passed recently. But, so there was a lot of changes in Clovis after that. Just some more headlines from the local paper at the time. So those are ones that we want to avoid, and so far we have avoided in Reedley. Another one, Beaumont, California. Similar stuff, although on a much larger scale with much, much more money involved. $43 million at stake. 6 were jailed. Guilty pleas. So this was kind of the underlying stuff. 6 years, the FBI and the DA investigated public agencies in Riverside and San Bernardino counties. So this involved...
That's a new area with a lot of development right now.
A lot of growth, yep. And so it involved some no-interest loans. So the city employees, city officials were getting no-interest loans from the city, which, again, as we get in later, I mean, that's, you know, not allowed, obviously. You're not going to get a no-interest loan from a bank or a lending institution, so why should the city funds be used?
I don't think
it falls out. Right. So, and then some misappropriation of some development impact fees as well. So, but it wasn't just the elected officials in that case. As you can see, city attorney, public works director, police chief, city manager, the city planner, finance director. So you had a whole group. I mean, basically just about everybody who would have been there for checks and balances was involved at that point. So, Yeah, that was a big one. So, what do you need to do? I think the important thing to get out of this, too, is you got to do the right thing. You want to be open and fair to everyone. Avoid self-dealing, okay? Do not work on projects that might have a financial effect on you or your family. Remain impartial and avoid bias, whether it's a personal bias or, you know, financial bias. Those are really the underlying rules. And as I mentioned earlier, what do you do if a red flag is raised? Stop and confer, okay? If you're an employee, you could stop and confer with your supervisor, your department head. You could certainly contact the city attorney's office. There's online resources, the FPPC. We actually did recently get an FPP written opinion. So the FPPC, the Fair Political Practices Commission, we'll get into that in a little bit. They actually will issue written opinions if you pose your question and your issue to them and you give them, you know, the set of facts. Hey, I've got this issue. Here's the underlying facts. Here's what's happening. What can I do here? If you get a written opinion from the FPPC, that can be used as a defense to any, you know, obviously any FPPC, alleged FPPC violation, but even any potential criminal penalties. If you seek and get a written opinion from the FPPC, that can provide a defense. You can't get it, even if I was to issue something to you, that's not going to provide a defense. You can't say, hey, the city attorney told me we could do this, or Nicole told me I can do this. Not going to be a defense. Ultimately, the FPPC is the only one that can weigh in. And we usually, I think Nicole and I, we may offer advice, but it's really more on the council level to protect the council, not necessarily to give individual advice to any particular council member. We may recommend, hey, you probably want to stay out or recuse yourself on this particular one, but that's really given to protect the ultimate decision that the council is going to make. These cases are very fact specific. Conflict of interest cases are very fact specific. So you change one set of facts or one little fact, it could change the ultimate analysis in the case. So that's why the FPPC, it's pretty rare to get an actual written opinion from them, because again, they're going to make sure that you've provided every fact and it's completely accurate before they're going to issue something that basically is going to be binding upon them and protect you. And there's the rules are constantly changing. I mean, the rules change every couple of years on some things. The gift rules are, they're constantly coming up with more exceptions or different requirements. So it's not an easy thing to be able to reach a conclusion. But again, identifying the issue or being able to spot the issue is the most important thing. I always say trust your gut. You know, if you think, oh man, I'm not sure if I should be doing this, trust your gut. Your gut's usually right. Stop, think about it, and ask a question. Either go to Nicole or contact me or Sylvia or whoever it is, and make sure that we kind of vet it through first. So let's get into the substantive areas. Again, the four areas. So the first one is personal financial gain. So again, that's the bribery and the conflict of interest stuff. Bribery is easy, right? Public officials may not solicit, receive, or agree to receive a benefit in exchange for their official actions. Again, just like the Clovis Operation Rezone case, whether or not you're soliciting or someone's coming to you, if you accept that benefit in return for your promise or your vote or whatever it is to do something or deliver on something, that's bribery if you've received a benefit in return. Again, whether or not you solicit it or someone comes to you. Obviously, there's consequences, criminal penalties for that. Well, there's loss of office will be one. You're going to lose your office. Possible prison time, fines, restitution of the bribe. And then there can be attorney's fees, obviously, involved, too. So avoid bribery. That's an easy one to spot. Someone comes to you and offers you something, but it doesn't necessarily have to be money. It could be something else of benefit, but usually pretty easy to spot. Again, some examples. There was South El Monte, a city down south. The mayor pled guilty to bribery. I think he had accepted $45,000 in bribes from a contractor in exchange for approving contracts. Got 10 years in federal prison, right? And then there were state audits. I think, pending. So it not only affects, obviously, the elected official, but the city could be in a world of hurt as well with audits and things like that. And then you've got, you know, state folks coming around. You all may remember the city of Bell from, gosh, that's going on probably 10 years now, maybe 12 years. The city of Bell was just a mess. And that involved a lot of bribery, overpayment of employees, officials, things of that nature. So, I mean, they were still unwinding that mess years and years and years later. So as we talked about earlier, so the second set for personal financial gain, again, bribery is easy to spot. The California Political Reform Act, or the PRA, this is the statutory conflict of interest law. So this is found in the government code, and this is kind of what the FPPC primarily deals with. And it basically, the law is laid out right here. Public officials, whether elected or appointed, okay, so it involves, so the public officials as defined there would include the city manager, includes the city attorney, includes planning commissioners, should perform their duties in an impartial manner free from bias caused by their own financial interests or the financial interests of persons who have supported them. And we'll get into some more detail there. There's a number of exceptions, and we're not going to get into all the exceptions, but again, it's kind of a general framework for you to know and be able to spot the issue. The general rule, you may not make, participate in making, or use official position to influence a governmental decision if the decision could have a reasonable, foreseeable material financial effect on the official, immediate family, or any financial interest. That's the general rule, again. And it's not, again, I want to impart on you that it's not just participating. So recusal from the decision is the easiest thing to do. But the law actually goes a little bit further and says you can't even influence or try to influence it. Now, we'll get into an exception in a little bit where as a member of the public, you could speak against it. But you can't, on one hand, recuse yourself or someone from the Planning Commission recuse themselves because they have a financial interest. But then behind the scenes be going to Rob or Nicole or whoever it is and saying, you got to change the staff report. The recommendation has to be no on that project. You know, that would be an undue influence, even though you might not participate in the ultimate decision if you're using your influence behind the scenes on a manner or on a matter in which you have a conflict, that's improper as well. So again, the general public, so public generally or general public exception. Sometimes the question comes up, well, you know, I'm participating in a decision on the utility rates, the water rates, sewer rates, whatever it might be. Sometimes CDBG projects come up. Obviously, you're all impacted by those things. You live in the city just like everyone else does. But there's an exception to that, and it's the public generally or general public exception. No conflict where it's basically indistinguishable from other members of the public, okay? You're all going to pay the same utility rates, or it's a very large group that's going to, you know, be impacted by a CDBG project or something else. It's not unique to you or you as a group of council members, okay? It cannot be unique. As long as it's not unique to you as an individual and it's more at play for the whole public citywide or at least a large group of the city folks, then it's going to be okay. The neighborhood even would be enough. So again, it's not unique to you. Then it's an exception and you can participate in that decision. So again, the law looks at the materiality standard. So it's got to be a material impact, reasonably foreseeable material impact. And so there's five standards that are looked at under the law. So business entities, and those are basically investments you may have or companies you work for or have management responsibilities for. And these are all basically kind of laid out even in the Form 700 Statement of Economic Interest that you fill out every year. If one of these is triggered, then you provide more information. I'm not saying you have to provide information. You may just fill out the first page and that's it. But if something is triggered, then there's subsequent attachments that you can fill out for these things. Sources of income is the next one. And sources of income, what they mean by that is, you know, if you're, let's say, a salesman, and, you know, one of your regular customers would be a source of income to you, okay? Sales of goods or services, and that can include your spouse. Gifts, obviously, gifts are considered for financial interest purposes, and we'll get into a little bit more detail on the gifts. Officials immediate family members, personal finances, the materiality standards there. And that really is dependents and those who live in under the same household. There are very few instances, though, where it can be, you know, if you're an adult and you're living on your own, it could be an interest, something that your parents or a brother and sister, again, even though you're adult and you're not dependent upon them, there are some instances where those have to be looked at, but that's pretty rare. And then, of course, real property. That's the one I think that most of you may be more familiar with. The 500-foot rule is basically, you know, the general rule. Hey, if you're, you know, you own property within 500 feet of wherever the decision or whatever the project is, you need to recuse yourself. That's kind of the easy one to spot. Again, the FPPC, the Fair Political Practices Commission, they're the ones that enforce, look at the PRA, the Political Reform Act, and enforce it. They'll administer and enforce it. Consultants are available. You can get not only written advice, but you can call their number and get advice there. But again, even their advice over the phone is not going to provide you with, you know, a defense. It ultimately has to be just a written decision. But they're pretty good. I've contacted them a couple of times just to bounce issues off of them as well, just for a second opinion. Only written advice can be relied upon on a civil or criminal prosecution. Any questions so far?
Can you expound a little bit on that 500 feet? What was that registering?
Yeah, so we'll get into that actually right here. But the 500-foot rule, it's a general rule. So let's say, it applies to both residential or commercial property that you may own or have an interest in. If there's a decision that comes forward, let's say there's a project that is coming forward and is looking for a liquor license. You're within 500 feet or you own property within 500 feet, you're required to recuse yourself from that. A lot of cities will have, I've seen maps where they will plot the property that's owned by, you know, the five council members and even the five planning commissioners, and then have the little 5-foot radius around it. So the planning department will know, hey, here's a project that came in the door. Well, planning commissioner so-and-so is going to be within 500 feet. And, you know, this particular council member is going to be within. Because ultimately, I think it's staff's going to be the first ones that are going to know when the project comes in. You're not going to know what projects are being, you know, what applications the staff may have. But ultimately, when it comes to the planning commission or comes to the city council, then you need to be aware and you're going to have to recuse yourself. So again, we'll get into the five types of personal interests. Again, business entities, those are investment, employee management, and the materiality standard is 2,000 or more. So if you have an investment in a company and your investment's less than $1,000, not at issue. But if it's 2,000 or more, then it can be in play. There's a catch-all category as well. Not the subject of a governmental decision if it's material. And again, you go kind of on the reasonable person or prudent person would find it reasonably foreseeable that the decision's financial effect would contribute to a change in the value of the business entity or stock. Again, these are for business entities or investments, things of that nature. The next one of the five, source of income. Again, this includes your spouse's income as well. And this is, like my example was the salesman. So you have a customer, and it's income from sales of goods or services. Okay, so let's say, for instance, I don't know, Ray cuts hair. So one of his customers, right? If it got to the point where he was seeing $500 or more dollars from that particular customer in a given year, and a decision might impact that particular customer, so you look down the line, then he may have to recuse himself from that decision if it involves someone who is a source of income to him. So again, there's a test. There's tests for all of these things. And again, they're very fact specific. The official receives or is promised the income to achieve a goal or purpose which would be achieved, defeated, aided, or hindered by the decision. Okay. The exception, again, retail sales or business entities. If they're you know, if you're just a retail sales clerk or somewhere, that's not considered a source of income to you. It's the business as a whole. And if you don't have a management stake in that particular business, it's not a source of income to you. Again, very fact specific. One that you probably see more often, or at least comes up more often, at least for, I think, Nicole and I, would be source of gifts, $500 or more, 12 months prior. I don't think we've had any of these necessarily come up, but sometimes they can, at least whether a gift is at play can come up. So the gift rules change every couple of years. They increase the amount. It used to be like 300 and something. Now it's up to 500. So there's more on gifts later, but I will say just the $500 is the number to keep in your head, as well as $50. So those two numbers are the important ones, as we'll get into. 500 is the line in which you cannot accept more from a single person or source of a gift in a given year, more than 500. $50 is the reporting requirement. So if you receive gifts in the cumulative from one single source in a year, a calendar year, that equal or exceed $50, you have to report that on your Form 700, the little attachment. Again, think about it. Lunches, you have lunch with someone, you know, every month. That first lunch doesn't need to be reported, but if, you know, they're paying 10 bucks or whatever for you, by the end of the year, it's $120 in gifts. So you'd have to report that. You're not precluded from going to lunch. You're not precluded from having that person pay. All that would be required is that you just simply report it on your Form 700. That's what that requires. So we'll get into a little bit more on that. The fourth category, personal financial effect. Again, the materiality standard is $250. It's very low. Incomes, assets, liabilities. This is kind of an amorphous one, I'll say. But basically, this is the one that involves your official or the official's immediate family if they're going to receive a measurable financial benefit. Or, again, it could be good or bad. A good benefit, or it could be a negative benefit from that decision. Then you need to step back and think, okay, you know, is this decision going to impact me, my spouse, maybe an immediate family member somewhere? And then we can look into that further. The exceptions, and this has actually come up, I think, in Reedley a couple of times, at least with, I'm trying to think when that came up, the retiree medical benefits. Yep. So the exception here at the bottom, that's the retiree medical benefit decisions. I think, Anita, I think you were at play on that one for one, based on your husband. Yeah. So decisions involving retiree medical benefits, even though your spouse is a former employee and is eligible for retiree health benefits from the city, you're able to participate in that decision. And then the last one, Frank, this is the real property one. And again, this is the one I think I see more often than not, and it's pretty easily spottable. Again, ownership or lease. So if you're leasing property, if you don't own it, but you're leasing, you're renting, and the value of the property is $2,000 or more, the 500-foot presumption. And it is a presumption, but as you'll see later on in one of the examples, I mean, it's basically people treat it as it's a done deal. It's not worth fighting the presumption. I mean, you could fight the presumption and say, look, although the presumption says I have an issue within 500 feet, in my case, it doesn't apply. It's just not worth fighting the presumption. Commercial property, again, you apply the business entity standards. The first one that we did, the business entity, the first of the five, the $2,000 materiality standard, you apply that. And then there's the catch-all, and this is a fairly new catch-all rule from the last couple of years. Again, it would apply. I always advise folks, if you're within 500 feet, just recuse yourselves, and you're not gonna be involved. So this is the case, I think it's Port Winnemini, Wainimi, that's how you pronounce it, yeah. So a councilman was fined by the FPPC recently in 2016, and the facts are this, kind of a quick summary. So $3,000 fine imposed because he had not recused himself from a vote, and the vote involved the project. It's not exactly like a CDBG project. I think it's a little bit more in depth than that. But basically, a number a large amount of money was used for upgrades near his home. Right there, he was within 500 feet of the project in which the council needed to decide whether or not to spend that money on upgrades. He didn't recuse himself. And his argument was, well, the 500-foot rule was more of a guideline. Well, it's not a guideline. It's actually a legal presumption. The law will presume that you have a conflict unless you prove that you don't. That's why I say it's not even worth fighting the presumption. Just take it as a fact and move on. It's not worth it. And so in that case, again, no criminal penalties, but here he was fined by the FPPC, $3,000 fine. So probably not worth fighting. Just recuse yourself from that one. He should have just simply recused himself and avoided that embarrassment. So again, if you're disqualified, so if you're triggered in one of these instances and basically the conclusion is you should recuse yourself or be disqualified from the decision, what do? You don't participate, like we talked about, not only not participating up there on the evening of the council meeting, but not participating behind the scenes as well and trying to impact with staff. Do not discuss or influence staff or colleagues. So don't talk to the other council members as well. Identify the precise nature of the conflict at the meeting. I think most of you, if not all of you, have identified that before during the meeting when it's come up in the rare instances. Identify, hey, here's my conflict. I'm within 500 feet of this project. You stated up there and you walk down, leave the room. You don't have to technically leave the room if it's on consent. You just state your conflict and you can remain there. But for other things, if it's like a public hearing or something on the regular session, I think we always advise you actually walk out, leave the room. I think most of you all have done that on the rare occasion you have. But again, one exception, you're all members of this community. You have the opportunity to speak as a member of the community. So, and I've seen it done before. I don't know if it's been done here, but I've seen it done before where the council member will state their conflict. Hey, I'm within 500 feet of this project, so I won't be participating tonight. They step down. However, come up to the microphone and say, just for the record, as a member of the public, I am opposed to this project. And then or you state whatever reason. You still have a right as a member of the public to talk, but you can't do it up there. You got to do it here.
As a community member.
Right, as a community member. As a community member, you can do it. That's it.
Because I always thought you had to go outside. So how could I participate if I went outside?
No, you can state it here and then leave. That's it. So again, you can't do it up there. The law says you can't do it up there because up there you're still recognized as a council member. Here, you're stating it as a member of the community. Your opposition or your support, whatever it is for that project, but then you still need to leave. You should still leave the room and not be involved in that at all. But again, you have a right, you have a First Amendment right as a member of the public to speak on that item. It's your community as well. But again, you can't do it there, you got to do it here and then still leave the room.
Not during a public hearing. Is that right?
No, you can. Yeah.
Oh, that's, okay.
Yep.
I misunderstood.
Another city to the north of us where somebody would step off the dais, recuse themselves, but stand in the room and sort of make
glare and exactly
when people were speaking to really bias the decision. That's why you step outside the room, because even your clearing your throat at certain times could indicate a bias.
The public is not, I'll just tell you, the public is, depending on who's here, the public is not necessarily going to believe anyways that you're not participating in the decision or you don't have some influence. They just don't know how it works. So they're always, I think, going to be skeptical and assume, even though Bob's not participating, he's still, he talked with Mary before the meeting or he talked with Frank or whatever. So in Nicole's example, if you're standing back there, arms folded and, doing that, they're absolutely still going to believe that, it's just a sham process and Bob stated he had a conflict, but he's really still participating, So it's always better to leave the room. Do it for, the integrity of the process, I guess, at that point. There's a special rule for contracts, and I can't say that I recall ever dealing with this in Reedley, but it's come up before. So this is an absolute prohibition. Government Code 1090. Public officers, and so that's not just elected folks. That could be department heads, Nicole, city attorney, you know. Public officers, as it's defined, may not be financially interested in a contract in which the city is a party to. So it applies to both oral and written contracts, although most contracts are going to be written. A legislative body, so here you are the legislative body, is prohibited from entering into that contract if a member has a financial conflict of interest in the contract. Abstention doesn't do any good on the actual contract except for that limited exception, the rule of necessity. So essential goods or services, it really would only come up in a very small town, maybe an isolated city, where there's only one provider in town that can do that, or nearby that can do that, and the city council member happens to have an interest in that company. Okay, so the city wants to contract with that company for whatever it is, goods or services. That would be a very limited exception, but usually you would be prohibited from doing that. The city could not enter into the contract with that person. And again, recusal doesn't do any good. So just let's say, for example, Bob, again, you own a business and the city wants to contract with that business. Just because you said, hey, I'm going to recuse myself, can't do it. Not allowed. It's absolutely prohibited under 1090 from entering into a contract in that instance. Again, except in that limited exception.
So if he was a business owner, he could not apply for a contract with the city. Right?
Correct.
He's an elected official.
Correct.
And neither, there was a case down in Southern California where a city hired a member's wife because she was a lobbyist, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And Nicole's example is perfect. It's the spouse, obviously, is involved here. But I always say, at least from the city's perspective, it's not horrible for the city, but it's really horrible for the official. Because again, the law recognizes that contract was void. So the city can recoup all the money that was paid and basically not have to ultimately pay a dime. But the official has to pay everything back. But it still just doesn't look good. It's horrible for the official. You're going to lose your office. I mean, that's one of the ramifications of it. But it's still not good for the city as well, just the headlines and everything. So here's another case study. So, and I've actually had one in the school district context where you had an official that had a local travel agency business, and the district wanted to enter into a contract. Again, one of five, we're going to have contracts with five different travel agencies in town. And we'll just use them on a rolling basis. But if one of the elected officials has an ownership interest in that travel agency, you can't do it. So again, voted on consent, even though it was on consent, doesn't matter. Failed to disclose on the statement of economic interest, the Form 700. And then the possible fine was 76. Ultimately, the FPPC reduced the fine basically to match the cost of the contract. So again, the penalties for a 1090 violation, the contract's void and unenforceable. Again, that's kind of good for the city. Basically, we can get out of the contract. But there's criminal, civil, and administrative sanctions for the official who had the ownership interest in the company or the contract, and with a conviction. So if there's a conviction, so on the previous one, I don't recall if this one had a conviction. I think FPPC just fined. But with a conviction, a criminal conviction, then the public official is forever banned from holding any public office. So pretty harsh penalties for the 1090 violations. You know what? This is probably a good time to stop as we're getting close.
And then the next meeting, yeah. Maybe start 15 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's fine. Yep.
Okay.
So we'll stop there.
Good job, Scott.
All right.